But Pastor Reed asked if I would come and give you my version of the story. You know who I am, right? I am Mary, Jesus' mother. I loved being Jesus' mother. I knew from the time the angel came and spoke to me that he was a special child. He would be a unique and maybe extraordinary person. And so I waited. I waited as his mother for the day when he would show us some sign, some miracle of who he really was, when he would show the world that he was God. Well, in the meantime, while we waited, we lived a very normal life. I was his mother. He grew up to be a carpenter. He worked very hard. I can just tell you that when I was with Jesus, things just seemed to be all right. I was filled with inexpressible joy when he was around. And the story that I'm about to tell you is one of those times. We were at a wedding. We traveled, he and I and a few of his friends, we traveled the 8 miles from Nazareth to Cana. And weddings in my time were huge, elaborate affairs. There was much feasting and celebrating, music and dancing. Over the years, people have speculated just who this family was that was getting married and why Jesus and I were even in attendance. I can just tell you that we were close friends with these people. We wanted to be there. We traveled the long road to get there. And as the course of the days went on, I felt obliged to help out. I wanted to make sure that the wedding went smoothly. The host of the wedding had to treat their guests with great hospitality. Many traveled a long way. Sometimes it was a dangerous road. The host had to provide the food and the drink and the housing for all of these people. And again, it lasted for days. So when the days went on and the wine started to run out, I knew that I could do something. I knew that I had to help. I did not want my friends to suffer such extreme humiliation and embarrassment at having run out of wine. Plus, I knew that I had someone who could help. I knew I had Jesus. I went right to him. Jesus, Jesus, they are running out of wine. Please do something. Do anything. Well, his exchange back to me might be a little surprising to you, but it was no matter to me. I knew that he could fix this. In fact, I went right to the servants who were working the wedding, and I said, go to him and do whatever he tells you to do. I did not know what Jesus was going to do in that moment, but I knew he would do something. And something I've learned about Jesus is that he sometimes surprises us. He gives us what we need, but in a completely unexpected way. So he told the servants, take these 6 stone jars and fill them with water. These stone jars were huge, taller than me, large, wide around. They held 20 to 30 gallons of water each. And these stone jars were used for cleaning, for purification. At this point in the wedding, many of the guests had gone through and used the water to wash themselves, wash their hands, wash their feet. That was what the water was used for. You would not ever take the water out of the stone jar and drink it. So you can imagine what the servants must have thought when they put the water in the jar. But they did. And they didn't just fill the jars a little bit. They filled it to the brim so that the water was spilling over. And then Jesus said, draw out a cup of the water and bring it to the master of the feast. And this is where the story gets a little unbelievable. The dirty water that was in the dirty stone jar was brought to the master of the feast. The servants were probably wondering if they were going to have a job after this. And when the master of the feast brought the cup to his lips, it was no longer the water. It was wine. But it wasn't just any wine. It was the richest wine they had served in the whole wedding. It wasn't just acceptable wine. It wasn't just passable wine. The wine was the best they had tasted all along. And the master of the feast complimented the bridegroom for serving such excellent wine towards the end of the wedding. He thought that most people would serve their best wine at the beginning of the wedding. And he thought it was wonderful that the best wine was saved for the end. This has been my experience with Jesus. He doesn't just give us what we need. He gives us the best. He surpasses our expectations. And yes, he sometimes surprises us. So how can you experience this with Jesus? It's all in my story. When you are incomplete, when you are empty, when you have a need, you have to turn to Jesus and tell him, ask him. Then you have to listen. Listen to what he says, even if it is surprising and unexpected. And then you must obey. And when you obey his words, like all of the guests that were at the wedding that day, you can enjoy the richest of things, and you can enjoy your relationship with Jesus.
Someday I'm going to write a book about my experiences in ministry. And when I do, I'm certainly going to have a chapter in that book on weddings. We have my friend Peter Brown here from First Baptist Wakefield, and he's nodding affirmatively to that. Everybody wants the wedding to go perfectly, but it never does. I remember a wedding that I had here a number of years ago. It was probably among the largest of the wedding parties I've ever handled. They were spread out across the front. I think there were 18 or 19 or 20 people in the wedding party. And as I conducted the ceremony, I could see out of my peripheral vision to my left one of the ushers taking a face plant. I assumed that we were going to conduct this wedding no matter what, so I just stood there for a moment, nodded affirmingly to the bride, "Don't be nervous," while the other ushers dragged him out of the sanctuary. He was fine. I knew what it were. And then there was another wedding, which the groom arrived 45 minutes late. And now you might think that maybe he got caught in traffic, but the truth of the matter was, he had been dating this young woman for 17 years and was extraordinarily ambivalent about getting married. Not so much about her, but getting married. I think he was frightened. We had the sanctuary full. There were about 320 guests in the sanctuary. It filled every seat in the sanctuary. And as time went on, people were looking at their watches. They knew that he was very afraid of what he was about to do. So 45 minutes later, as I was sweating bullets out to the side here, he pulled up and we walked in together and everybody rose to their feet with a standing ovation. Then there was the wedding in which, in the face of her anxiety, the bride began to giggle. And she giggled, and she giggled, and she giggled, and such that it became contagious. And the rest of the wedding party began to giggle, and it seemed like an eternity while we waited for everybody to stop giggling. And then another occasion in which the bride began to cry, also in her anxiety. And she cried and cried, and again we waited for what seemed like an eternity. And then there was another occasion in which we had the candles burning at the front here on a communion table. It was shortly after we had installed our air conditioning, and I had not anticipated the fact that with the air conditioning blowing, there would be a slight breeze blowing over the candles. As I conducted the wedding ceremony, I could see people glancing furtively to the right and to the left. I didn't know what they were doing, but when I turned around during the lighting of the Unity candle, I could see that the candles that were burning on the outside through the ceremony had been burned down to about this size because of that slight breeze. So we managed to accommodate that, and they lit their Unity candle. And then there was the other occasion, and that's not why you've come to hear these stories, but it's all about weddings today. The other occasion in which, at the rehearsal, I had done what I always do. I had said to the father of the bride, "When you give her away, be very, very careful as you step back. Step backwards, do everything in halftime speed, and then take your seat." Well, in the anxiety of the moment, he forgot all of the instruction that I had given him, And rather than stepping back slowly, he stepped back quickly, and rather than stepping back straight, he stepped back to his left, until we all heard this massive tear in the wedding dress. Well, I won't go on with any more of these stories. You see, the glitches happen in weddings. That's just the way it is. And no matter if the glitch is big or if it is small, it does not affect the fact that the bride and the groom eventually get married. Well, 2,000 years ago, there was a glitch in a wedding. It wasn't so much in the wedding itself as it was in the reception after the wedding. They had run out of wine, and as you heard a moment ago, this was a huge faux pas in a culture where hospitality was a sacred duty. Now, let me tell you a little bit about this story from the scriptural perspective. There are two levels on which you could look at this story. There is, first and foremost, and perhaps even more importantly, there is the permanent level, what I describe as the permanent level. And by the permanent level, I think it is the abiding truth that resides in this story that John wants us to have understood. On this level, you have to understand, if you look at verse 11 here, you'll notice that John refers to this miracle as a sign. In fact, he refers to all the miracles of Jesus, not as miracles, but as signs. And the question that begs is, okay, signs of what? Signs point to things. Well, the sign here, this first of the miraculous signs of Christ, John intends to point to a deeper truth, an abiding truth, a permanent truth. And what is that? Well, you understood from what Kelly shared a moment ago that these six stone jars, which were rather large, as she indicated, these six stone jars contained water for washing. They washed the feet of the guests as they arrived after their dusty journey, and they washed the hands, if they were strict Jews, they washed the hands of the guests after each course in the meal. This was part of a ceremonial washing consistent with the Old Testament instruction. Notice that, and notice also that there were six jars. If you know anything about Hebrew understanding or thinking, you know that six was a number that represented imperfection, incompletion, if there you would. Imperfection or incompletion. Six water jars. Notice also in verse 4 that when the jars are filled and transformed, they are filled, so John says, to the brim, overflowing. Another important detail, all of which point us in the direction of the sign pointing to the permanent truth. Put this all together, and this is what you get. You have six stone water jars used for ceremonial washing to fulfill Old Testament law, transformed into wine that was overflowing. What is John pointing us to? That the water of the Old Testament law is now supplanted, transformed by the wine of God's overflowing grace. The wine of Old Testament law is now transformed by the wine of God's overflowing grace. That's the abiding permanent truth to which this sign is pointing us. It is changeless, it is timeless, it is eternal. That having been said, I'm not going to approach this story on the permanent level. I'd like to approach it not from that level, but to look at it from what might be described as the practical level. This was a wedding, and you heard a moment ago about what weddings were like in that first century. They went on for about a week, and the bride and the groom were treated regally. They wore crowns. They were able to give orders to people as if they were a king and a queen. It was a royal, so to speak, celebration, and a very, very festive occasion in a culture where poverty and hard work were the norm of the day. You can understand the climate, the culture. So that when the wine ran out, this was more than just a social embarrassment. This was more than just a social faux pas. This was something very, very big. It was said in the first century that wine, without wine, there is no joy. That's what the rabbis used to say. And that doesn't mean that the wine made people drunk. No, that was kind of a hideous thing in that first century. It meant that the wine represented the joy of the occasion, the festivity, the life, the vitality of the occasion. Without wine, there is no life and there is no vitality. So the absence of wine was a commentary on this marriage. Something of a portent on the marriage relationship. And that would not do. And here's what I want to point you to. That when Jesus acted, the joy of the reception was restored. When Jesus acted, the joy of the reception was restored. It wasn't just the wine. It was the joy that the wine represented. And here is the practical truth that I want to highlight or underscore today. It's very important for us. When the wine runs out in life, it is Jesus who restores the joy. I need to underscore that and repeat it because it's very, very important. When the wine runs out in life, it is Jesus who restores the joy. Now, I've lived long enough, as have most of you, to understand that there are seasons in life when the wine runs out and the joy is gone. It's simply a part of being a human being. Some of you might be in that season right now where the joy is really hard to come by. The wine has run out in your life. Maybe some of you and others who might be seeing this week are really working your way through a really struggling marriage, and you're afraid that your marriage relationship is going to come unglued. You're worried that the wine has run out on that relationship. Maybe you are faced with a financial crisis of sorts and you're pinching pennies and you're wondering how you're going to pay your bills next month. Maybe you've lost your job. The wine has run out. The joy is gone. Maybe some of you are faced with a very serious illness. Currently, I'm praying for 5 people who are really faced with serious cancer issues. For those people, the wine has run out. The joy is gone. Life is difficult. Some of you may be living in a situation where you are really feeling bone-crushingly lonely. And you put on a happy face and a smile for everybody around you, but nobody can see inside your heart, your mind, and your soul. And they cannot recognize, therefore, that on that level, the wine is gone. Others of you may have difficulty at work. Maybe it's a struggle to get up every day and to go to work because the relationship that you have with those for whom you work is not good. And I had a long conversation with a person this week who found it a chore to go to work every day. So what do we do? What do we do when the wine runs out? I think, believe it or not, there's some very practical advice here that can be gleaned from this passage that will speak to the circumstances of every single one of us when we find ourselves in that situation. Look at verses 1 through 4, for example. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." What did Mary do when the wine ran out? She did what we all should do when that happens to us. First, when the wine runs out, you turn to Jesus. Turn to Jesus. A few weeks ago, I had referred to me a young woman who was on duty when those young twins were brought into the hospital in Linfield. You saw it on the news. 2 little girls died. They drowned. This young woman was one of those who were professionals in that situation. And she was having a great deal of difficulty coming to terms emotionally with that event. She was encouraged to come and talk with me, which she did. And she laid out the whole experience for me, and as she spoke, it was, as you might imagine, a hideous description. We arranged to get together in subsequent weeks in order to provide a situation in a setting where I might be able to, you know, in some small way, facilitate her healing through this process. She called me the second week and said, you know, I don't need to come back to see you. And I said, that's great. She said, I found more help in talking with you than I found with any of the others with whom I spoke, and I'm feeling better. Now, I said to myself after that, was that me? No. She had chosen to come to me as the earthly representation of the Christ whom she knows. And it was Jesus, the contact with Jesus, the turning to Jesus, that began to fill her soul again with joy when the wine had run out. Another thing we can see, not only do you turn to the Lord, you submit to the Lord. Notice verse 5. Mary says to the servants, do whatever he tells you. When you are in a wine having run out place, not only turn to the Lord, but turn to the Lord and submit to him. Become obedient to him. If you're in a depressed place, for example, you need to submit to the promise of Christ where he says, I am with you always until the end of the age, Matthew 28, verse 20. I will never leave you or forsake you, Hebrews 13, 5. If you are in a frightened place, turn to 1 Peter 5, 7, and listen, cast all of your anxieties on him because he cares for you. If you're in a weary place, go to Isaiah. They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not grow weary. They shall walk and not grow faint. Turn to the Lord and submit to the counsel and the correction that he offers you. If you're in a place of feeling guilty, it's an awful place to have a wine run out place inside of you because you're guilty over something you've done or said, and the joy is gone because of it. Then turn and submit to Christ and receive his forgiveness. I said several months ago that I had a great deal of concern for somebody like a Tiger Woods. Because as we were reminded by Brit Hume on television shortly after the events were announced, there is no forgiveness in Buddhism. And yet the acts that he committed are acts that demand forgiveness. He's in a very, very difficult place. And I'm not inside his life or his circumstances, but one has to wonder as they watch his performance decline. When you are in such a place as that, turn to the Lord and submit to his counsel, his comfort, or his correction. And if you do that, somehow, some way, someday, a sign happens to you too. A miracle happens in your life too. It is inevitable and unavoidable that in the wine having run out places, when you turn to Christ and submit to him, somehow, some way, someday, over time, the joy begins to be restored. Even if the circumstances don't change to your satisfaction, there wells within you a transformation where the water of your emotional life begins to transform into the wine of God's abundant grace, where the water of your spiritual life, having run dry, is transformed and filled overflowing with the grace of God's glory. Turn to Christ, submit to him, and watch and wait as that transformation unfolds. Jesus laid hold of these water pots, this water, and transformed it and turned it not just into joy, but notice, into abundant joy, so to speak. It was filled, were these pots, to the brim. That's a point John wants to make specifically, filled to the brim. And when we think of it in the context of God's joy, our lives are filled to the brim. Abundant joy is given to us when Christ is given the opportunity to transform our interior life. This past week, Nancy visited a friend whose husband had died. He was well along in years. And I asked her about how the lunch went with his grieving widow, and she filled me in on the information and then shared this with me. She said, this man, this friend's husband, who was well along in years, had died, but he wanted no funeral. Why? Because he was an atheist. And I asked, how did that come about? She said, well, as a younger man, he had had some very difficult, strenuous, painful experiences. He had a wife walk out on him. He had a child who walked away from him. He had some very, very difficult experiences. This was many, many years ago, and somehow in the emptiness, wine having run out place, rather than turn to the Lord and turn in submission, he turned away from Jesus into that dark hole of atheism. And Nancy said to me, do you know what his dying words were to his wife? And I said, no. This is what he said. And now into the nothingness. That was like a blow to my stomach. Can you imagine the joyless, empty, frightening affirmation that that represents? And now into the nothingness. A man with the opportunity to experience the transforming joy, but who walked away from it and followed the course that left him with the empty water of mere life. Well, I need to end on a happier note. And that happens to do with the wedding that we celebrated yesterday. Some of you know Joan. Some of you have met her now husband, Matt. When Joan first started attending our church, she was in a relationship with a young man whom she had placed a high hope on. And she was coming along in years, into her 30s, and had really high hopes for this relationship. It didn't work out. And when it didn't work out, as you might imagine, the wine ran out. The joy, in a lot of levels, was sapped from her life. And that's when I first began to get to know her. She and I were talking in my office. But she said something over the course of our conversation, toward the end of our visits in talking in my office, that really struck me. She said, I know, I believe in Jesus. I know that he has a plan for my life. I'm going to keep my faith in him, and I know that whatever comes my way is what he has wanted for me. And within a very short time, she met Matt. Matt was a Christian who had been waiting a long time to meet a wonderful Christian young woman. He, too, was in his mid to late 30s. They met, the sparks flew, the joy began to well up, and today they are embarking on a new life together. God works in a variety of ways to transform the water of your life, the empty wine place of your life, to restore the joy. But this I know, if you turn to him, and if you submit to him, he will engage the transformation. You can take that to the bank.